This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, it's Health and Living, it's our Doctor in the House series. So Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist in the studio with me. And today we're going to have a really interesting discussion about the accessibility of a possible life-saving medicine for COVID-19 and whether or not we as Malaysians will have access to it. So Welcome to the show, George. How are you today?
I'm good. It's just 2 weeks I'm not seeing you. I'm having withdrawal.
And it will continue to be every 2 weeks, George, because I only work every other week in the office.
What a life.
Oh. Yeah, Are you saying I don't work from the house?
Well, working from home can be open to interpretation, right?
Oh, come on, George.
Actually, I like this new norm. I'm sure the new normal, you know, suits many people, and it opened up a lot of opportunities and also way of life, way of thinking.
Really. How has it changed for you?
Well, actually, I read somewhere recently, someone sent me an article saying that overall it changed many things in many people. Actually, one of them is consumerism. Actually, that reduced quite significantly. I can see that in my credit card bill, so I'm very, very happy. And cooking healthily, eating at home, and then thinking about what you eat, exercise. I continue to sustain that. And also be more flexible with time and also think of prioritizing things in life.
Don't lie, you've been taking food from your neighbor. I see pictures of it on Instagram all the time of food coming over the fence.
That's right. That's social distancing.
You lucky devil,
yeah,
I
Michelle
tell you.
Was thinking. So you don't have to. I said home cooking. I didn't say who cooked the food from home, right?
Okay. But yeah, you're right. The whole working from home thing every other week has its advantages in that, you know, you have a little bit of a breather. But I do miss having the team all back at once in the office. Yeah. I think we are going through some kind of a, you know, we're missing our other half of our team. But, you know, we'll just have, this is the new normal, I suppose. We'll see where it all goes. So that's what we're going to be discussing today. It was recently reported that the US bought almost all available supplies of the antiviral drug called remdesivir.
And naughty Donald.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. And remdesivir is actually, as I said, an antiviral, which sort of helps improve outcomes for COVID-19 patients. In particular, it is, let me just go through some of its benefits with you. Where am I?
It's an antiviral.
It can speed up recovery, but it may cut the chances of dying of COVID-19. This is according to the manufacturer, Gilead. Among severely sick people, the antiviral drug reduces the risk of dying by 62% compared with standard care. And for the first time, these researchers have direct evidence that the antiviral drug can halt replication of SARS-CoV-2, the coronavirus that causes COVID-19, in human lung cells grown in lab dishes and in animals. So it's very, very encouraging. However, with the US buying up so much, what will be that implications?
Yeah, well, at a second, I was shocked to hear that, because prior to that, I didn't realize, that US was obviously doing that. Obviously, being the most affected country in the world, they probably have the rights, in many ways, in air quotes, to gain access to all that drugs. But leave some for the poorer countries, right?
Well, that is one. And the other thing is the US Department of Health Services says it has secured more than 500,000 treatment courses of remdesivir. Mm-hmm. But really, the US is seeing almost 3.5 million cases, with the number of daily new cases in the tens of thousands. So 3 months, I don't know how long that's going to last. Joining us to have this discussion is Dr. Mark Cheong. He's a lecturer and pharmacist. And Sangeeta Sashikant, she's a program director on development and intellectual property from Third World Network. Welcome to the show. How are the both of you today?
Very, very well, Mira and Josh.
Thank you very much.
Nice to meet you.
Yes, you are welcome. Okay, who wants to go first? I want to know, how much of an impact will the 3 month supply have on the US fights against COVID-19?
So I could go first. I think, just as a background to remdesivir, I think it's important to note that remdesivir was first developed for Ebola. It was not very successful. It is now approved and largely for emergency use in several jurisdictions, the US, EU, Japan, India. I think an important thing to note is that it's not a proven effective therapeutic to treat COVID. Some early results show that you might recover earlier, 11 days instead of 15 days. In the last 1 week, Gilead is claiming that it reduces mortality, but earlier results did not show that. So clinical trials are actually underway, and there are a lot of other therapeutics that are actually also being tested for the treatment of COVID. Now, what the remdesivir case shows is some of the challenges, and that is why it is very interesting. It shows some of the challenges countries will face in terms of access. So as you mentioned, the U.S. government has actually bought up the global supply of remdesivir. And here, one big issue, apart from the fact that the U.S. government is hoarding, is the price of this remdesivir. So, for instance, the price that Gilead has set is $390 per vial, global price for developed countries, which is about $2,000 plus for six vials. And it's charging the U.S. $520 per vial. And this is although, so this is really expensive. You are talking about scaling up treatment because the cost of production of remdesivir is estimated to be less than a dollar a day. So, and the Indian companies, generic companies in India are actually able to supply it for less than $60, between $50 to $70 per vial. So a big issue is the issue of price, especially given the fact that there has been a lot of public funding that has gone into the development of remdesivir. So one estimate is $70 million from the US, from several countries, $70 million that have gone into the development. A US representative has been talking about $100 million that has been spent by the US government. So a lot of public investment that has gone into remdesivir.
Can you elaborate access, a little bit about the public funding? What does that mean?
That means they have given
The government
funding to the government has given, yes, the public funding that has gone into the development of remdesivir is publicly subsidized to make it.
So yeah. Taxpayer money is being used.
Taxpayer money. That's right. Taxpayer money.
But
is
now we've
got to
pay tons
extra,
of money for
extortionate
it.
Amount.
You know how to pay high. That's right. And really high prices. So discounting the fact that we are in a pandemic. In terms of access, so this behavior of Gilead is creating a lot of global concern amongst developed countries. Gilead has entered into what we call voluntary licensing agreements with very specific companies in India, Pakistan, and Egypt to manufacture for license for manufacturing to lower middle income countries. But the problem is we do not know the terms of the license. And it excludes, I think, at least half the population of the world, including a lot of lower and middle income countries.
Could you explain to us what voluntary license agreements are?
It's a bilateral license between Gilead and a generic manufacturer. So giving them the right to manufacture, for instance, and to supply. So the agreement would state the countries it could supply. I think it's 127 countries, but we do not know the other terms of the license.
Okay, so we have a problem with that because Malaysia has been excluded from that, which means, what does that mean? Malaysia will not be able to get generics from the three countries who have been given the voluntary license to manufacture?
No, what it really means is because remdesivir is not patented in Malaysia, so Malaysia is free to source from other generic suppliers. For instance, there is suppliers in Bangladesh. They could potentially source from them. So they could have a look at alternative sources of supply.
Okay, so
the voluntary license is because it could be patented in a number of countries. So the voluntary licenses is Gilead giving the right to manufacture to several generic manufacturers.
Okay.
To supply other countries.
Sure. Yeah. Mark, what do you think of the situation? I mean, what are your thoughts? Is it ethical to allow drug companies to sort of monopolize or countries to monopolize supply?
Yeah, thanks, Meera. And I think, I heard from George earlier on about them being shocked at this. And I would contend that, we're unhappy about it, but not necessarily surprised. You know, it's, and again, to answer your question then, is it ethical? Probably not. But are we surprised to see a country essentially choose to protect its own citizens by buying up an entire global supply? It's kind of one of those things that we do expect to happen. And I think really then the question is that, you know, how have we allowed a situation or an environment which allows these things to happen? So one of the things I'd like to point out as well is that despite the fact that the United States has bought up the entire world's supply of remdesivir, even all the way until September, it's still insufficient for their own users. We have hospitals in the United States which are unable to get remdesivir for their patients. Shortages are reported everywhere. And to me, this speaks to a larger problem of having enough of any one drug or any one treatment for COVID for the rest of the world. And this is due to the fact that under the way we currently operate with patents and with intellectual property, the way the pharmaceutical industry operates, if you only have one manufacturer, one company who is allowed to produce and sell this thing, then it's not going to be enough for even one country's own users. So we've got to find a way to actually ensure that this technology, this product, which works, let's say, for COVID-19, is being able to be shared across the world with as many people as possible who can actually manufacture it to ensure that the global population, in the global population, there is enough of a supply of this drug so that everyone who needs it can get it.
Does the rest of the world have any power at all? The US is now pulling out of the WHO. Will the WHO have a say in this? How do we control the situation like this?
I think again with the US doing what it's doing, it's really a sign of the times. We have rising nationalism, and a term that's come up, especially when talking about COVID drugs or COVID vaccines, is drug or vaccine nationalism. And I think the solution to it, again, is a global solidarity. And we're seeing that even with the United States pulling out of the WHO, that gap in leadership is very quickly filled by countries like Germany, by the European Union, who are, at least on paper, bringing together the rest of the world to try to look for a global solution to this problem.
Mark, I mean, Sangeeta started the interview by highlighting that this drug is not really that effective.
It's not proven.
Number one, it's not proven. And actually, it's only in kind of like a non-prospective randomized trial basis that this is not really high evidence to suggest that this is a very effective drug against COVID. And under that circumstance, already someone is hoarding up all the drugs. Just imagine there's another drug that comes up, which is very effective. What would the world come to?
I know. And if it hasn't been proven, what are we patenting and what rights does Gilead have?
Absolutely. I think you've hit the nail on the head over here. And I absolutely agree with Sangeeta's assessment on remdesivir and its effectiveness. This is really a drug that hasn't been impressive by most measures, you know, or by our expectations of what a COVID-19 cure should look like, right? But there is already a fight for this, and it's the same thing happening in the vaccines arena as well. You know, we are looking at vaccines as the potential key to our freedom from COVID-19. There are hundreds of vaccine candidates. None have come into existence, but there is already jockeying and there's already been purchase commitments being made for some of these candidates. And I think what's a bit more alarming to me is that the fact that countries are actually putting in hundreds of millions of taxpayer money into these candidates, none of which have been proven yet. And this investment of taxpayer money, things that they take out of our paychecks, is essentially going to many of these firms with no strings attached. You know, questions have been asked by organizations like TWN, for example, about, you know, if you put in a couple of hundred million into a vaccine candidate and that candidate fails, well, do you return whatever money is left over? What happens? Or does the company just say, well, this gamble's over, thanks for playing, and you know, I'll keep the rest of it?
Yeah. Okay. interesting, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
I'd like to see where Malaysia stands in all of this, because in the past, Malaysia has stood its ground. It rejected Gilead's voluntary license offer for Sofos Buvir, which is an antiviral for hepatitis C. Of course, we got a lot of backlash for it. However, it brought down the cost so much that the government is now able to give treatment, three-course treatment for hepatitis C for free for Malaysians with hepatitis C. So,
can we work the same magic?
I don't know, actually. But, you know, I already was wondering then, would that then sort of rub pharma companies up the wrong way? And would we then have to bear the consequences of that with new drugs in the future? And here we are. Right.
Potentially one of the reasons why Malaysia was not given license, you know, for the generic.
Yes, and we would be bypassed because of that. Right? Because we invoked something called a compulsory license, not a voluntary license. We'll come back and get Sangeeta's take on what the difference is. That's coming up next. We are discussing access to COVID-19, a potential COVID-19 life-saving medicine. And if you have a question, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, or you can tweet us at BFM Radio. Good afternoon and welcome back. It's our Health and Living segment. Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist in the studio with me. It's our Doctor in the House series. And today we're discussing remdesivir, if you're wondering what that is. It's an antiviral that the US has now bought up supply for 3 months from July, August and September, hoarding in a way for its people because it is supposed to help with the recovery of COVID-19. Remdesivir is made by Gilead, which is a pharmaceutical company, and it was originally trialed to combat Ebola. Preliminary analysis has shown that remdesivir improves recovery time for COVID-19 patients with severe symptoms. Those who have severe symptoms seem to have benefit from it. Now, if it is not as proven or, I don't know, some people say effective, but not the greatest, you would then wonder why would a country hoard or buy up and hoard it, right? Is it this idea of panic then, Sangeeta? What do you think?
Yeah, it could be because they are struggling. If you talk of the United States, they are struggling to contain the pandemic. And I think in the US, it's also the politics of it where the administration, the White House administration, is kind of ignoring the situation. And so there is a lot, the dynamics in the US is slightly different. Apart from remdesivir, actually, there are a lot of other drugs that are currently in clinical trials. A drug that has now shown, at least the results are showing that it significantly reduces mortality, is dexamethasone, where there isn't any patent barriers. It's an old steroid. So this is one option. Another option that is, again, these are all very preliminary results, is Sofos Buvir and Daclatasvir combination. Some small study done in Iran shows that it actually reduces mortality. So I think there are different, and there are a number of therapeutics that are actually under clinical trial that are being tested. And I think maybe by the end of this year, there could be a bit more clarity as to what works. So remdesivir is, if you like to look at it, it is an option, definitely, but it is, if you look at the preliminary results, I think the question is, in a country like Malaysia that has kind of relatively contained the curb of COVID-19, it's an option, but it's not a necessity as such, because we have kind of worked. And I think this is a very important public health approach, to do surveillance, to do testing and tracing. And that's the approach that that Malaysia has taken. And so in that context, Malaysia is definitely on the right path.
But we are also running remdesivir trials in the country?
We are.
What does this mean? What does this mean for us?
Remdesivir is part of the WHO Solidarity Trials, which is happening, run by the World Health Organization, and it's happening in a number of countries. And I understand remdesivir is being offered as part of the clinical trial. So to the extent that that trial continues, we have access to the remdesivir drug, I imagine.
On the trial basis?
On the trial basis,
because
yes.
The rest of the supply has been protected or held by bigger countries. Is that correct? In Malaysian setting?
Yeah, it's hoarded. Yeah. Yes, it's hoarded. But Malaysia does not have the number of cases that the US has.
Yeah.
So I think we have to question whether Malaysia would need it. Yeah.
Sangeeta,
but there
I don't
are also,
know.
As I said, there is no patent barriers in Malaysia. So Malaysia is free to import from generic manufacturers, is free to manufacture this drug. It does not have to be included in the voluntary license you mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Malaysia is normally, even before this remdesivir issue, is normally excluded. It's considered to be a upper middle income country. It's normally excluded from most voluntary licenses, from what I see, except for voluntary licenses for pediatric formulations, but otherwise it's excluded from most voluntary licenses. So it's not linked to the compulsory license that you mentioned. The fact that Malaysia is not included is two facts. One is there is no patent barrier. Mm-hmm. There are no patents in Malaysia, so there's nothing that stops Malaysia from sourcing a generic or to manufacture if there is capacity to manufacture that. Secondly is the fact that, we are normally anyway excluded from all voluntary licenses.
That's what I was, pardon me, Dr. Noor Hisham has said that, that we are,
yes.
And these are exactly his words, our country has always been excluded under voluntary license, although we're a developing country. Hepatitis C, we're excluded under voluntary license, where he denied Gilead's claim of previously offering voluntary licensing to Malaysia for its Hep C drug, Sovas Buvir. But let's talk about that. We use compulsory licensing for Sovas Buvir. Mm. What's the difference?
So compulsory licensing. So normally for intellectual property, the minimum standards are stated internationally in the World Trade Organization. There's an international agreement known as the WTO TRIPS Agreement, and this sets minimum standards. Under this minimum standards, it's recognized that the intellectual property can be abused by the holders of intellectual property, and governments should have the policy space to take steps, measures to protect their essential interests, and public health is an essential aspect. So that the international agreement itself has got flexibilities, and the use of compulsory license is a flexibility under international law, is perfectly legal, is perfectly valid. And what Malaysia has done is it did try and negotiate with Gilead. The prices did not come down. I remember in 2015, a patient paid more than $70,000 to access Sofos Buvir. Right, which is, and you must understand that this Sofos Buvir with a combination with another antiviral can cure hepatitis C.
Mm-hmm.
It's a curable disease, right? So if patients have to pay such high prices, it's not sustainable for the government.
Correct.
To provide. Yeah. They cannot roll out free treatment. And this is what Malaysia was struggling with. And even if it comes down to, say, 10,000, 6,000, it's really expensive to actually roll out treatment. And at that time, it was estimated that the burden of hepatitis C was about 500,000 people who would need it. So Malaysia did, my understanding was they did discuss with Gilead. Gilead refused to include Malaysia in the voluntary license. So Malaysia utilized what is perfectly their right under international law and is also stated in the Malaysian patent law, to exercise, to issue a compulsory license for government use. So then we call it government use license.
Mm-hmm.
They managed to bring down the price to less than $300 importing the generic from Egypt.
Okay.
$300.
Sure.
And I think the prices Malaysia has obtained are some of the lowest in the region.
So, you know, so, Mark, Sangeeta, what we're worried about now is access, right? Well, half the world population probably will need it. And if access is limited, how then do we get supply of it, right? So let's just say we have a vaccine. Somebody produces a vaccine in the world and everyone's got to be scrambling for this vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you are free then to play around with price. And I can imagine that this vaccine is not going to cost...
it's not going to be cheap.
No, it's not going to be cheap at all. So then, can I ask you if... countries in the world can invoke compulsory licensing to allow to bypass the manufacturer to get access to generics of a vaccine, for an example.
Mm-hmm. What's stopping us from doing it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think that's an interesting question, and certainly, as Sangeeta has rightly pointed out, the right to use a compulsory license when, let's say, public health is at stake is absolutely a legal right for every country to take. Right? I think the question then becomes, why doesn't every country invoke a compulsory license to take what they need
or do it
to
more
give
often.
To everyone? Yeah. So behind the scenes, there's often a lot of political pressure. Right? So you have big countries with large flourishing pharmaceutical industries. You know, there's lots of lobbying. And even within our own country, there's lots of lobbying. And that can sometimes dampen the political will to actually invoke these compulsory licenses. The other question, of course, is a compulsory license a silver bullet to this problem? And the unfortunate fact is that it is not. While a compulsory license can help us bypass a patent, there's a lot more that's involved with, let's say, the development and the manufacturing of a vaccine or a drug that may not be in the patent. There are trade secrets, there's technical know-how in which may not be listed in a patent. And you can have the patent, but you won't be able to manufacture the thing yourself. And I think this is where globally now there is this push in order to get pharmaceutical companies, people who do R&D for vaccines and these drugs, to actually share all their technology, voluntarily open up, pool your technology together, pool all your information together, all your know-how together, so that individually the global population and each country is able to take that comprehensive information and build their own local manufacturing bases in order to ensure that then whatever vaccines or drugs we need for COVID-19, you have enough of it because we can manufacture it locally and it's affordable. Mm-hmm. See, a lot of the discussion that we've been having about, you know, getting access through breaking patents, these are all symptoms of a business as usual model. And we are right now, we are in the middle of an unprecedented global crisis. And it doesn't make sense to me that we are using a business as usual model in order to meet the challenges of an unprecedented global crisis. With COVID-19, I think the phrase that's been bandied around is that no one is safe unless all of us are safe, right? So it's no use if, let's say, just one country has the vaccine or two countries have the vaccine. Anybody from your neighboring countries, let's say with unvaccinated infectious people with COVID, can come into your country and then spark the infection in your country again. The only way we will be free from COVID-19 is if all of us have it. So this is really one of those inflection points in history where we've got to consider putting aside business as usual and see, you know, how do we come together in global solidarity to solve this global problem together?
You know, just a couple of days ago, our Minister of Science, Technology and Innovation, Kari Jamaluddin, he says that the Prime Minister has agreed that two local pharmaceutical companies will set up facility to fill and finish the COVID-19 vaccine once it's made available. I think that's great thinking, ahead. However, what should be our priority as a country right now? I think we can have that facility, but if we don't have access to the vaccine, then what happens?
It's just the facilities without the drug, right?
Yeah, so
absolutely. Yeah. So, because you can't fill and finish if you don't have something to fill those bottles with.
Yes. Right. Yeah. So what should be our priority as a country be?
Well, I think in terms of priorities, so we absolutely want to encourage our pharmaceutical, local pharmaceutical industry to be able to manufacture vaccines, you know, starting perhaps with fill and finish, and then eventually if we can get our hands on the technology to make these vaccines for ourselves. However, I think there is also this fixation on a vaccine as a silver bullet that, you know, that will essentially cure all our problems or free us from COVID. The estimates are that we won't see an actual vaccine even by the end of 2021. I think any estimates that say, you know, you might have it by the end of this year or even the early first few quarters of next year, I think those are very optimistic.
Believe the Russian stories from yesterday then?
Unfortunately not. But I think what's perhaps the bigger priority is that we continue our public health response. I think that's the silent silver bullet that we have. You know, we continue our public health response. We continue having every Malaysian doing their part, social distancing, wearing a mask, and keeping the infection numbers down. And like Sangeeta pointed out, if we do that, you know, the number of infections come down. We don't need that much remdesivir, or perhaps none at all. You know, if we can all do our part in that. So I think that's where the priority lies.
Yeah, but that would also mean we can't allow people to come in and infect us, Mark, Sanita. I mean, we have no control over that. And trade needs to continue. I mean, people need to move around, right?
We can't lock the doors of the border forever.
No, we can't, unfortunately.
Obviously. So I think that's where you have short-term, mid-term, and long-term goals. And certainly to get rid of COVID, the long-term goal or even the mid-term goal is to have the entire world vaccinated against it, or as some estimates will point, at least 80% of the world's population to be immune to COVID. But right now, I think if let's say in the short term, if the obsession and all of our energies goes towards, you know, how can we fight for a cure, how can we fight for a vaccine, and by doing so, let's say we redirect our efforts away from our strong public health response, I would consider that a bit misguided.
It's really quite shocking, isn't it, that some people in the world think that they live in isolation and forget to see that we are one ecosystem. I wonder that when that will actually sink in, if not with some governments, with its people, perhaps. We'll come back after the market update. I want to find out if, for an example, greater international solidarity is required. What does that actually mean? And two, we need a more public health-oriented approach to the development of these new treatments. What does that actually mean? And you know what? Does the WHO have power at all? We'll come back and find out up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. If you have just joined us, it's our Doctor in the House series, which means it's a Friday, and after this, I can go home.
Yeah, absolutely.
Many of us can go home after this. Right. You know, we've had this heavy discussion about access.
Stay home for a whole week.
George, I work. He still thinks I'm lying on a deck chair for 1 week before I come back the following week. we're discussing, you know, access to life-saving medicine for COVID-19 because we know the US has bought up almost all available supplies of the antiviral drug called remdesivir for the next 3 months. So we're discussing what this means really for the rest of the world. I mean, the sense I'm getting is like, you know what? It's no big deal for us at the moment because we have our numbers under control. As selfish as I sound, it is not really the gold standard drug as such yet.
Not yet.
We have
Don't
access,
worry.
Yeah, we have access to others. Our worry is, of course, vaccine. And if there is indeed a very effective antiviral that comes about in this time, right? What does that mean for the rest of the world? So I earlier spoke about the need for greater international solidarity, which is what the both of you have alluded to. And a more public health-oriented approach for the development of new treatments. Sangeeta, what does that mean? How do we have a more health-oriented approach to the development of new treatments?
So clearly, when we talk about, what we are facing is a global issue, right? So it's a Malaysia issue, and Malaysia has successfully managed to contain it. But it's a bigger global issue, right? Because we need this international trade, we need people traveling. So what really is needed is international global solidarity. And when we look at this from a public health perspective, it's really, we know there's going to be shortages. We really need to ramp up supply. I think this is really one of the most important things we can do globally, ramp up production, ramp up supply, making sure that intellectual property is not a barrier, sharing of intellectual property, technology transfer. And I think we would like that, you know, countries should not be hoarding, should not be taking more than they require, the share that they need, they require. And here, at the international level, a few things are happening at WHO. WHO has set up an initiative with various global health actors called the ACT Accelerator. And this has three pillars: diagnostics, therapeutics, and vaccine. And the whole objective is really to accelerate the development of diagnostics, therapeutics, and vaccines, and to ensure equitable access so that no one is left behind. So this is really the mission of it. Second thing is WHO is working on a global allocation framework. to ensure, although a lot of the focus is on vaccines, to ensure that everybody has equitable access. So this is something happening at the international level. WHO has also launched something called the Technology Access Pool. This is a statement of commitment by that they have launched, calling for sign-ons by countries, by companies, for the sharing of knowledge, know-how, technology, so that there can be more international solidarity around it.
Well, that's interesting, because Australia has not pledged its support to the Technology Access Pool.
So much politics involved.
Why does everything come back to politics, really? Can we get rid of politicians?
Calm down, deep breath.
I know, deep breath. Can't the WHO just come out and say, I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen, we have a new drug available and it's going to be available to everybody on a humanitarian basis. Why can't we do that?
I think a lot of it has to do with our understanding and our perception of perhaps what the WHO is. And I think, for many of us, the WHO seems to be this global, all-reaching organization that, you know, that comes around and, you know, imposes its will to solve health problems around the world. But I think the reality is that WHO coordinates its advisors, but what the WHO really is, it's its member states. You know, the WHO is made up of essentially the member states, countries, governments, politicians that represent these countries. So sometimes when there's criticism that, you know, why doesn't the WHO just do this? In reality, it's what we are saying is that why haven't countries in the world decided to do something about it? Why haven't they decided to come together to actually act on it? And so, unfortunately, Mira, we can't get rid of the politicians because the politicians essentially form up the WHO.
You know, and all of them have had COVID-19. Many of them have caught it, you know. That's the irony, right?
Many of them recovered as well.
I know, yes, they have, you know, without being horrible. But, you know, that may have been a wake-up call if, you know, some of them didn't recover and it was a catastrophe. Mm-hmm. Perhaps then somebody might see, you know, but there's so many people dying in the process. So, Sangeeta, you had something to say.
No, I think it's an interesting thing because when you talk about a wake-up call, I think what we are seeing it's a wake-up call in also in the developed countries, the European, in US, where they are facing huge problems of access. And they themselves are actually trying to make it easier. Well, previously they used to criticize, say, for instance, Malaysia for using compulsory license. They themselves are actually thinking about it as a tool and making it easier. They are actually changing their laws to make it easier to use compulsory licensing. Mm-hmm. Israel, for instance, was one of the first countries that issued a compulsory license for lopinavir, ritonavir, because at that time it was thought that it would be effective in the treatment of COVID. They just issued a compulsory license because we could not supply them. Yeah. So it's a wake-up call to developed countries that there are all these different access issues that countries will face that have become even more stark in this context of pandemic.
Did all these compulsory licensing have any repercussion for the nations who invoke them?
I don't think so. I think compulsory license is not something new. It's been done by a lot of developed countries in the past. It's just now developing countries are using it. It's their right. And there is a lot of political pressure that is put on countries not to use compulsory licensing. But I think the interesting thing that we are seeing in the last few years, even before the pandemic, that it's an issue that even developed countries are grappling with. For instance, a federal court in Germany issued a compulsory license, allowed the companies to issue a compulsory license for the use of a HIV drug. So, and I think the pandemic has shown they're all changing. Many of them have changed their laws to make it easier to issue a compulsory license because they do anticipate intellectual property could become a barrier in the ramping up of global manufacturing.
So what's a way forward for countries? You said, Mark, that they should all come together and, you know, stand in solidarity against, doesn't sound convincing, Mark. I mean, I have no idea. I can't even visualize how this is going to happen.
Well, actually, I mean, as ideal as that sounds, I think we are seeing that in response to, you know, the nationalism that's being demonstrated by some countries like the United States, there is actually, you know, signs that in response to that multilateralism responses coming back in. You have countries, again, as I mentioned earlier on, Germany coming to step forward and to invest. You have more liberal countries like New Zealand stepping up and saying, we're going to put in X amounts of millions into, you know, into developing these vaccines through public-private partnerships that, you know, that we will share with the rest of the world. So I guess it can happen. And again, this may be one incident, maybe one event that people say, well, let's put down all our usual nonsense and let's come together, because no one's getting out of this unscathed if we continue business as usual. But the fact is that, you know, as ideal as this sounds and perhaps as unconvincing as this sounds, this is the only way. We don't have a global police. There isn't a global government, no sovereign king, you know, to lay down the law and say that everybody needs to follow this. The only way we have forward is for all of us to move forward onto that. And so again, then sometimes the question then becomes, well, then how do you get governments to do that? And I think this is where you have citizen activists, you have civil society. Every one of us needs to apply pressure to our politicians and through them, through our governments and through governments together, to apply pressure to, let's say, recalcitrant countries to say that, well, this is the way that we need to go and we all need to come together in line. So all of us are involved in this.
You know, as you were speaking, I found the answer.
Yeah, I found the answer too.
Did you, George? Are we thinking the same?
Well, I don't know. The whole answer is...
I think every country should be led by a woman right now. Now. And we will get through this, you know, really.
Right, okay. I was thinking of it another way, right? Okay. If Mark, I mean, you mentioned something earlier on about all these patents has to be shared, the secret has to be shared. If the vaccine of the drug is not patented, then we never have this problem, right?
Yeah, precisely. I think if we decided to say that, well, we've discovered something and it works and, you know, here's how to make it, we share it with everyone, then you essentially, this whole discussion doesn't need to happen.
Exactly. And right? Then that has happened before for, is it polio vaccine that was never patented? And it,
absolutely.
If that is the way forward and everybody is protecting their interests and things, and, you know, why don't all the people who invest the money in it and then come to an agreement that whatever is discovered, the secrets are, there's no secret, it's all transparent, and there's no patent at the end of that. And then it's a solution for everything.
Would you have a message for us, Sangeeta?
Yeah, I think globally this is the push that if there is a lot of public investment going into R&D. I think one figure was 4.5 billion across the world, with the EU, the US, a lot of other countries have put in a lot of public funding. And the call for civil society is all of this have to be conditioned on terms and conditions such as access, affordability. So I think this is a big call. There's also a big a call by a number of world leaders for actually any vaccine that comes out, it's what we call people's vaccine. It should be available. It should be as far as possible free at point of care. It should be affordable. So I think these are all calls and issues that civil society and many other actors are taking up at the international level, including the sharing of intellectual property. It's not necessarily in the case of vaccines. I think there are the current trials that are happening. I think about 10 to 13 are at this phase 2, phase 3 trials. They are on a number of different platforms, and sometimes the platforms are proprietary as well.
Sure.
So we have to see, some of these are quite novel technology, so we have to see how that comes up.
Mark,
but yes, the message is a lot of public funding is going in. It has to be subject to conditions.
Mark, your message.
Well, I think, so as we've been speaking, we all have a role to play, and from civil society to politicians to the man on the street in fighting COVID. And I think, you know, one person's been left out, and that's really the pharmaceutical companies. And I think pharmaceutical companies have absolutely one of, if not the biggest role to play here. I personally see COVID-19 as an opportunity for these companies to really be the real heroes here if they are willing to openly and voluntarily share their technology for COVID-19 for the benefit of mankind. Because here right now today, these companies have the chance to demonstrate to everyone that when it counted for the most, they were willing to step up, put aside short-term profits for the good of everyone. And if you're willing to do so, we don't need to have these discussions about compulsory licensing or, you know, the aggressive posturing about pricing, so on and so forth. So I really highly encourage them to take full advantage of this opportunity and help us get out of this mess.
George?
I have nothing to say. I was so heartbroken when Mark said that we won't get anything until 2021. In the meantime, I'll just carry on washing my hand, wear my mask, and chuti chuti Malaysia lah.
What's so bad about that? It's hardly a problem. You know what? We're going to root for no patent and women to the fore.
Yeah.
Thank you, ladies
absolutely.
And gentlemen, for joining us today. Dr. Mark Cheong, lecturer and pharmacist, Sangeeta Sashikant, program director on development and international intellectual property from the Third World Network. And of course, Dr. George Lee, consultant neurologist, my co-host for Doctor in the House on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.